I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What the Black Mountain College produced in the middle of the last century could be seen as an artistic response to a world falling apart. In the shell shock of the Great War, then the Great Depression, Hitler rising, apocalyptic weapons falling, a new Armageddon at hand in the Cold War. And in the piney woods of western North Carolina, a perfectly astonishing variety of young painters, poets, experimental dancers and composers, weavers and potters too, casting about in new directions and new combinations. The world as it is isn't worth saving, said the Black Mountain founder. It must be made over, with art at the broad center of everyone's education. The star power is still staggering in that Black Mountain cast. Bucky Fuller, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, who founded his dance company at BMC, sculptor Ruth Asawa, painters Rauschenberg, Twombly, the de Koonings, all in key chapters of their lives. Here is the poet Robert Creeley on the start of his major career.
I had never been in a company where tacitly everyone seemed to know what I was variously concerned with and talking about. It was wonderful, like a dream.
And the painter Jacob Lawrence from Harlem in the 30s.
What we were able to achieve under great odds in terms of the content, in terms of the form, our capacity as human beings.
The majestically white-suited German design master Joseph Albers presided at BMC, a peculiar example of both austerity and liberation. He's remembered for us by one of the last survivors of BMC, Ted Dreyer Jr., of Belmont, Massachusetts, who grew up on that campus by Lake Eden.
Joseph and Annie Albers did not have any children of their own, and they were close friends with my parents, and so to some extent we were a little bit their kids, in a sense. He would sort of say, "Oh, look over there. Isn't that something? Now, just look at that." It would just sort of draw my attention to him, and then when I was a student of his, he would say, Oh, yes. You wouldn't get any other words that interfere with your close perception of the color or the design or something. See, be open to what is there. Be open to what is there. This was a poem I wrote about Joseph Albers, and it's called New Vision at Black Mountain College. New Vision at Black Mountain College. This I learned from Albers at BMC. Be aware, be aware. Yes, be aware now and begin to see. He brought us into that experience of somehow seeing more.
Louis Menand is our lead-off guide to the Black Mountain idea in Asheville back in the day, and the spirit that comes alive in a traveling show of art, music, film, and poetry that opened at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston this winter. Louis Menand reviewed the show for The New Yorker magazine. He wrote his masterpiece, The Metaphysical Club, about a sort of BMC precursor, a cluster of thinkers around William James and Oliver Wendell Holmes 100 years earlier, who invented pragmatism in the wreckage of the Civil War. The BMC idea sprang in 1933 from a classics professor, John Rice, who had been famously fired from a college in Florida for having too many eccentric ideas about teaching.
Rice was very influenced by the educational philosophy of John Dewey. Dewey was a member of the board of trustees of the college for a period and believed in what the college was doing. What was that? That was essentially adopting Dewey's philosophy of learning by doing and adapting it to higher education. So most pre-K programs in the United States and lots of other places in the world essentially use a Deweyan philosophy. That is, they believe that children learn best by doing things, making things, drawing things, singing things, and so forth. And that was very much Dewey's idea. Dewey thought that the purpose of education is to make people good citizens in a democracy. Mm. And that involves what Dewey called associated living, doing things with other people and in the world. And that was what Black Mountain was committed to.
The notion is somehow that every man, woman, and child is born to be an artist at some phase or in some dimension, right?
I think that it does depend on that idea. And that's true for when we teach little kids, too. It's the idea that everybody can draw a little bit. Everybody can make music a little bit. Everybody can dance a little bit. And there's no reason why when somebody gets 18 or 20 or 25 years old, they should stop doing those things. Mm. And if you tap into that, even at that age, they don't have to do it well. They just have to do it. And they'll, by doing it, develop certain capacities they can't develop in any other way.
1933, Hitler is suddenly in power. Joseph Albers and his Jewish wife shut down the Bauhaus or withdraw anyway. They can't imagine it in Nazi Germany. Explain that connection.
Yeah. What's a little unexpected about Black Mountain is how German it was. First of all, Dewey's philosophy of education is basically German. That's where it all comes from. It comes from German educational philosophers going back into the 19th century, even the 18th century. That's where it came from through Dewey. That's where it came from. A lot of the progressive theories of education that are not just from Dewey come from this German tradition. So that's one thing. And the second thing was the influence of Bauhaus. And the idea behind Bauhaus was very similar to Dewey's idea, which is that art making encompasses much more than just the fine arts. It includes making products and design, and it includes the way cars are built, and includes this whole visible world that we construct around ourselves is kind of art. And that's the way Albers taught. So he had students go collect materials from around the campus, leaves and pieces of wood and all kinds of stuff that they found in the garbage and everything, and make art out of it, to show them that the activity of art making is not limited to these Beaux-Arts traditional materials. And that's obviously a big influence on somebody like Rauschenberg. So I think that the most influential group of people who came out of the Black Mountain experience were Rauschenberg, John Cage, and Merce Cunningham.
The big three in paint, sound, and dance seemed to cue each other across the arts. Robert Rauschenberg left a famous set of canvases in blank white house paint. John Cage made his most famous piece out of silence. Here are Cunningham, then Cage, with the Zen taste they had cultivated for serendipity, pure chance.
A music which was not dependent upon the dance, nor the dance dependent upon the music, but which were separate identities which could, in a sense, coexist.
It's less like an object and
more like the weather. Because in an object, you can tell where the boundaries are. But in the weather, it's impossible to say when something begins or ends.
When they became famous, starting around 1958, they were the group of artists who carried American culture to Europe. And people often talk now, I think, in a very lazy way about the abstract expressionists being weapons in the Cold War and Jackson Pollock being used by the American government to promote some idea of American art. It's actually not true at all. The group of people who did do that kind of, if you want to call it, cultural imperialism were Rauschenberg and Cage. They had enormous influence on European artists, and Cage had enormous influence on avant-garde music in Europe, particularly in Germany. They learned from European models. They had European teachers, but they took an Americanized version of that abroad. What was that? Essentially, it was proto-pop art. Mm. I wouldn't call Rauschenberg a pop artist exactly, but it was pop that really became the American lingua franca and then the world lingua franca for contemporary art in the 1960s. And Rauschenberg was a great ambassador for that. And, of course, Rauschenberg later became incredibly wealthy, but when he became world famous, but that wasn't why he got into the business at all. And I think that's what's interesting to us to look at, to see people who were incredibly talented, who were not in the arts because it had anything to do with making money. So I think people who went there had to be driven by a conviction that they wanted to do something that was important and they could live with the deprivations that everybody had to live with. And that goes for the teachers as well. This was the art world before there was money.
Philosophically, what are the oldest impulses inside this place?
I think philosophically, it comes from this German idea of Bildung. The spirit of hands-on learning really does come from Germany, and also does this idea of Bildung. So when the United States basically imported the German model of higher education in the years after the Civil War, that's when the modern research university begins to come into being in the United States. That's when Harvard and Yale and Hopkins and Columbia and Michigan and Stanford create graduate programs and all of that. They imported the German idea of research, of Wissenschaft, as the primary mission of higher education, but they didn't really import the idea of Bildung. And what Bildung means is education as a form of self-cultivation, of making yourself a certain kind of person. And we don't really emphasize that so much in American education. It's a complicated idea. It doesn't translate very well into the way Americans think about the purpose of education, but it's part of what's behind the Deweyan idea about learning by doing. It's to create yourself into a participant in a democracy, a citizen. That's what Dewey thought the end of all education should be. It should be to make the democratic experiment continue effectively. And you could only do that by socializing people in a particular manner to make them the kind of people who understood what it meant to participate in running one's own life in collaboration with other people.
Whether you were an artist in the end or not, you might be a carpenter or a teacher.
Right. No, you didn't have to be an artist at all. You could have a radio program.
That's historian Louis Menand of The New Yorker in his Harvard office. Coming up, the Globe's art critic Sebastian Smee on the uncanny glow in the objects at the ICA, Annie Albers' hand weaving, Jacob Lawrence's Black Watchmaker at Work, John Cage as the original remix master. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lightman. This is Open Source, the show of Black Mountain College work at the ICA on our Boston waterfront. Can feel like a nine-ring circus of experimental artists all egging each other on to leap before you look. Curator Ruth Erickson is my guide inside the show, starting with John Cage's random mix of all sorts of sound.
This was Cage's second summer at Black Mountain College. It was the summer of 1952. He had 8 tapes of pre-recorded sound that he had recorded around New York City and elsewhere, probably like 600 feet of pre-recorded sound. And he had this idea that he wanted to create a collage of sound. Cage ended up working on a graphic score, which is literally a drawing of where the different 8 tapes would be cut and spliced together. And so you see here 2 pages of this graphic score. And this is, in fact, the kind of key of what you then hear in what many people call one of the first pieces of electronically derived music, music that's derived from these pre-recorded sounds on magnetic tape.
Ruth, who knew John Cage was the first modern DJ, mixmaster, and who knew he was a graphic artist with his music notation?
Yeah. There are so many sounds. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of pre-recorded sounds. You hear traffic. You hear people talking. You hear snippets of other music that I presume to be a radio. You hear sometimes restaurant sounds. It's really, I think, the sounds that were in Cage's life, the sounds that were in the spaces that Cage inhabited as he lived in New York and as he traveled. And I should also say that the title, Williams Mix, is in honor of Vera and Paul Williams, who were Black Mountain College students and really important benefactors to Cage. They, in fact, funded this piece to be made.
Do not change your radio dial. That's the way the music sounded.
or the sound sounded. Sebastian Smee in our studio is the Boston Globe art critic. You wrote wonderfully on the show, Sebastian. Give us your two bits as we travel here.
Well, look, Chris, it's just such a great show to walk through. I mean, you would have felt that yourself. It was great to hear those sounds coming over the radio as well. I mean, it's a show that has, in some ways, a kind of archival feel as you go through the beginning of it. It focuses on the great teacher Joseph Albers that we heard about, and Annie Albers, and then it sort of builds to a kind of crescendo, and there's this final room which has works by Rauschenberg next to works by Cy Twombly. Who are both very much in their formative years. It's got a wonderful hanging sculpture, woven sort of metal, by Ruth Asawa, who's a fascinating figure. And it has a sort of, semi kind of recreation of the famous happening, supposedly the first happening, which was this...
Remind me of the players.
Right. Well, so you had Rauschenberg sort of... it was all organized by John Cage. And he wanted people to perform different things and do different things according to their own sort of time signature, but at the same time. So you had Rauschenberg playing Edith Piaf record at sort of double speed. You had Merce Cunningham sort of dancing around, followed by a dog. Accounts of the event differ. There are various versions. You had Charles Olson reading poetry aloud and so on. So you have obviously that couldn't be completely recreated, but you have these big white canvases that Rauschenberg made for that event, suspended from the ceiling, and a sort of piano and so on. So, as I say, it does build to this crescendo. And I think one of the things I'm interested in about the show is the fact that we remember Black Mountain partly for the great people who went there, the artists who went on to sort of forge great careers. And so the question is, how much of the school was creating those possibilities that led to that greatness? And how much were those few sort of really singular artists in some way kind of kicking against some of the things that were taught? I mean, it's interesting to me that we associate Joseph Albers with color, but there was Rauschenberg making all white paintings or all black paintings. same with Twombly, not much color going on there. I mean, Albers thought Rauschenberg was one of his worst students. And there was
tension for the rest of their lives.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Listen, in a capsule, the Rauschenberg drowning story and what it tells you.
Well, this got my interest. It's not really covered anywhere, but there's an account in a letter by Charles Olson to Robert Creeley, and it was fascinating to me. It's a bit involved, but very briefly, you had a situation one night where they were down in the dining hall bashing out music, Rauschenberg and Twombly and a few others, a piece by Morton Feldman, I think the experimental composer, was a friend of John Cage. Charles Olson had a busy day. He had taken over the running of the college. Joseph Albers had left not that long earlier. It was snowing. It was cold. He wanted to see to something in his car. He needed a flashlight. So he came down to the dining hall, and he said to Twombly, he interrupted his piano playing, said, "Look, where can I find a flashlight?" Twombly said, "It's in Rauschenberg's car." He starts walking up the hill, and then he hears someone cry out, "Olson, the flashlight!" And he turns around. And then he senses there's a kind of urgency to the whole situation, and realizes when he looks out at the lake, and I've been there, by the way, I sort of went down to Black Mountain a couple of months ago. Really great to be able to picture all this. The dining hall's right by the lake. What he saw was that Twombly was sort of heading out into the lake. Remember, it's freezing and snowing. And he's calling to someone in the middle. And Olson looks further out toward the middle of the lake, and there's Robert Rauschenberg. And no one knows what he's trying to do. Is he trying to drown himself? Is it a cry for attention? We don't know, but he was sort of tasked with having to rescue him. Twombly was too cold. He had to turn back. And at that point, for some reason, the whole event sort of, terrible kind of anticlimax. Rauschenberg slowly starts coming back in. But he's suffering from terrible hypothermia. Olson has to sort of wrap him up and bring him into the dining hall.
Olson is soaked and unhappy about it, right?
He is. He's very unhappy. But what he's detecting is that there are these tensions between Twombly and Rauschenberg. They're very fond of each other. Rauschenberg's already married, by the way, and has a child. But they seem to be falling in love, Rauschenberg and Twombly. And they're also, I think, perhaps in a competitive kind of relationship. And that's another thing you get going on in art schools, right? You have a lot of rivalry and jealousy and envy. Twombly's had a great year. He showed at a gallery and being celebrated by lots of people. Rauschenberg's had a tougher year. A show at Betty Parsons kind of crashed. And he's just feeling awkward, and he's in love, and he's married, and he's worrying about his sexuality. So it's a gossipy story. Black Mountain College is filled with these kinds of stories, but it really grabbed my attention.
You're not going to top that one. back to the show. Here is curator Ruth Erickson again with one of the painting gems in the whole scene from the African-American Jacob Lawrence, both realist and abstractionist, in his documentation of the great black migration out of the Jim Crow South.
Jacob Lawrence's Watchmaker, which was made in 1946, is kind of a social realist documentation of the American scene, portrait of the watchmaker's craft. The scene is this kind of great camp green background. It looks like there's a series of boards, and on top of this green background are these brightly colored clocks. Two are blue, three are orange and red. And they're kind of hanging all over the back scene. And I particularly like the way in which this light, which is illuminating the work of the watchmaker, but kind of hangs down in the space, this heavy black form with this light bulb hanging out of it, illuminating a emphatically black figure. He's wearing a blue striped shirt, which picks up some of the blue of the clock faces. In front of him are these golden yellow pieces of the clock that he seems to be working on. You can see a crank, various pins, you can see a number of gears. The table looks like as if it's almost tipping up. And the space that the watchmaker sits in, it seems like a kind of collapsed or impossible space to inhabit. He kind of looks hunched over. His head in particular is craned and turned in such a way that the neck and head, there's almost no separation between them. They just become this kind of one turning form. And I think that that is certainly the moment where Jacob Lawrence is using abstraction to try and convey a more realistic portrayal of the watchmaker's work fixing the clock.
I should have said, the music is Duke Ellington's Caravan. No connection with BMC, except that it's a work of genius from 1936, and it's as fresh today as ever. Sebastian.
Yeah, it is a great work. I mean, it's wonderful to see it there. Jacob Lawrence was there, I think it was 1948, at the same time as Bill de Kooning. I mean, what a lot of people forget is that Black Mountain wasn't an art school. It was a liberal arts college, but it had the sort of the courage to put the arts at the center of its curriculum. And what happened is that during the summers, they invited star artists, or not necessarily stars, but a lot of great artists and architects and composers and so on, to hold summer classes. And over time, that's what made the college sort of become more and more associated with art rather than just the liberal arts generally.
Yeah, they invited everybody. And astonishingly, so many people did come. The Twombly,
right.
No, it was the de Koonings, I think, bargained to get $200, I think, for the summer,
right,
and including bus fare.
And Albers, by the way, had to get Jacob Lawrence onto a separate train because of segregation and racism. He needed to organize sort of separate transportation for Jacob Lawrence, which is sobering, isn't it? When you think about what an incredible artist he was.
And sweet, he when the train got to the Mason-Dixon line. Joseph Albers put Lawrence in a private car.
That's what I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's a, you know, it was amazing the way so many significant artists sort of came along. And it, you know, the college had various phases. And, you know, in most accounts, there was just a lot of drama going on at every stage. You know, Rauschenberg said that every morning he'd sort of wake up and around the breakfast table there'd be various people in tears. And I think Joseph Albers was a very tough teacher. He was described in one Time magazine article as America's great disciplinarian. And so I think that's the thing about Black Mountain. It's so full of these contradictions. You have a sense of openness and
disciplinarian,
liberation.
Disciplinarian, but his instruction was look.
Right.
Look.
Right.
And find your own response. There's one more piece to drop in. Ruth Erickson again at the show, looking at something entirely different. It is the spare wooden desk that Joseph Albers himself designed and made with his own hands for Black Mountain students.
Joseph Albers designed and built this desk for students at Black Mountain College in the late 1930s. It has three very simple parts, an open rack of three shelves on the right, on the left are three drawers, and on the top is just a flat plane. It has the same kind of rudimentary, modernist, simple structure that you can see in his paintings, in his prints, and in his other work. He built this because at the time, Black Mountain College didn't have a permanent home, and it actually had to pack up the entire college for the summer months and move out of their buildings. And so he built this so you can just lift off the top and slide those two doors together and pack it really tightly up and then unpack it when school started in September.
Everything about it is so spare, so simple, so handmade, so economically designed.
I think that economy of form certainly had other ramifications at Black Mountain College because it was a school who so often survived on so little, and they were always trying to figure out the most, you know, economic way that they could approach creating a meal or planting a garden or creating a sculpture shop because the resources were so limited, being formed at the tail end of the Great Depression, you know, lasting through a world war. And so I think that kind of economy of design is very in line with what you see happening throughout Black Mountain College. I also think it's a great gesture to think of Albers, the great teacher, designing this for students. I mean, what a gift he was to give to students through this desk.
For me, the pieces you'd want to steal out of that show are first that desk, but also around the corner, his wife Annie's first piece of weaving that just knocks you over, red and a sort of brown twill in very, very subtle variations on a herringbone pattern with these black stripes dropped in.
Yeah, it's stunning, isn't it? And I think, you know, Annie Alba's role is absolutely crucial and not to be overlooked. In fact, it was her weaving that so impressed Philip Johnson, the modernist architect, who then recommended the Albers to come over and run the college. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, and you know, Annie Albers said this herself, her weaving was their kind of passport to America and to the whole beginning of Black Mountain. Her work's beautiful. It's also great to see her loom hanging in that final gallery, or not hanging, it's standing in that final gallery, by the sort of prepared piano. And so you have this sort of connection between, you know, these two, I guess, objects that are at the center of Western culture and civilization. On the one hand, a sort of a workaday loom, and there's that connection with not just sort of fine art, but with the idea of all the arts coming together, whether they be practical arts, design, and so on, or painting. And then you have a piano next to that. And you know, they've both got strings. They're both, you know, in some ways, they're interesting objects to compare. And it's a brilliant, I mean, I think the show, Ruth Erickson and Helen Molesworth have done such a great job with the display of the show, because you see all of these kinds of connections. The show is just fizzing with those sorts
Nothing
of ideas.
Nothing speaks more powerfully to me than that loom. I mean, does it not say, why aren't you sitting, reflecting, combining colors, patterns, warp, woof, hour after hour at that beautiful ancient device? I mean, it's so, what's the word? Human.
It is very human. And I, you know, that's a great word for it. And I think that point that Ruth Erickson makes about the culture of kind of making do, that was partly a product of post-war sort of deprivation, or not just post-war, but during the war as well. Mm. You know, the fact that they would salvage things, they would study leaves, they worked with colored papers, Joseph Albers' famous studies of the relative properties of color, how one color could be made to look completely different according to what was around it and the size of it and the shape of it. All these things were done with the barest means. And, you know, Rauschenberg's whole aesthetic of sort of collage and of putting things together. And he wasn't alone, by the way. Many of the other people who came out of Black Mountain College were doing similar things. All comes, I think, from that culture of making do and of putting things together and salvaging things. Mm. It's very poignant.
Very poignant. That piece has almost entirely disappeared from the art world, or should I say from our lives, the idea of complete simplicity, making do, try something with what you have, go and get it. Albers was always sending people out ashes. Even a cow flap becomes part of his teaching, looking at things differently. But anyway, the idea of
Working from where you are.
Mm. I wouldn't say that that has disappeared, though, actually, just to sort of pull you up on that. I would say that it just proved hugely influential, and it fed into conceptual art, minimalism, and a lot of art that's being made today. Yes, some art being made today is very expensive and gaudy, but so much of it comes out of this culture of everyday materials.
It's just disappeared from my day-to-day, but stand by. Coming up, Black Mountain Vibrations among working artists in our midst. And on the way, a dash of poetry. We're not doing justice to the whole school of Black Mountain poets who kept the brand alive for decades, led by Robert Creeley, Robert Duncan, and the man who came from and returned to Gloucester, Massachusetts, the bridge to the beats, Charles Olson. Here is Olson reading his poem, Kingfishers.
The Kingfishers. What does not change is the will to change. He woke fully clothed in his bed. He remembered only one thing, the birds, how when he came in, he had gone around the rooms and got them back in their cage, the green one first, she with the bad leg, and then the blue, the one they had hoped was a male. Otherwise, yes, Fernand, who had talked lispingly of Albers and Ancorvat, he had left the party without a word. How he got up, got into his coat, I do not know. When I saw him, he was at the door, but it did not matter. He was already sliding along the wall of the night, losing himself in some crack of the ruins. Yet it should have been he who said, the kingfishers, who cares for their feathers now?
This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, resonating with the brief, brilliant life of Black Mountain College in rural North Carolina, from 1933 to bankruptcy in 1957. The music here is from BMC in 1949, Lou Harrison's Seven Pastorals. BMC's artistic chief, Joseph Albers, remarked early on that it is not our ambition to fill museums. We are gathering experience. They made many museum pieces, in fact, but that searching, patient reflection on art and the human condition may still be what visitors pick up in the BMC Legacy Show at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. I'm putting it to artists in our studio to define something in that Albers inquiry that is alive and urgent in the air of 2016. Taylor Davis is a sculptor who's been part of the Whitney Biennial in New York and exhibitions far and wide. William Flynn taught her once, and many, many others. He is a master draftsman and master drawing teacher at the Museum School in Boston. Taylor Davis, you're a teacher too at the Mass College of Art and Bard, and you call this a teaching show. How so?
Well, first of all, the show is actually full of a lot of work that our student studies. So when you walk into the show, you're not walking into an exhibition of finished paintings that are held up to be seen as some sort of masterpiece. Yes, you see finished works by many of the artists that you were talking about, Sebastian, but you're also looking at color studies by students. You're looking at texture studies by students. So actually, in terms of teaching, it's literally laid out for us to see these works by these students as they were learning these things that Joseph Albers and Annie Albers and all their faculty were teaching them. The other thing about it, though, in terms of being a show that's so important in terms of teaching is that it addresses the idea of an institution that was, they had no board of trustees. You know, it was a college that was put together by faculty and students who were living and eating together and creating together. And it's an example of an institution that protected its boundaries in a way. I mean, it invited artists to come in and work there, invited students to come and be part of it, to actually literally make the school. Mm. But it also gave the students and the faculty a place to flourish. And at a time when, obviously, some of those faculty came directly from Germany. So it was a time in the world when there was a lot of incredible violence and destruction. And there in this valley in the mountains in North Carolina was a place that students were coming to learn how to see, to learn by doing. And the other thing that's also so important in terms of its learning is that one thing that was taught consistently across faculty, across medium, was that there was no absolute truth. And that phrase, there was no absolute truth, was, you know, that was first actually spoken by, in one of the quotes by Alpers. But, I mean, that meant a huge thing to them, right? They were taking, that quote came from somebody who just came from Germany. Mm. But to bring that into the heart of the teaching, to actually realize that when you're teaching students, you're teaching them how to make choices, right? And that was one thing that was really amazing in that amazing catalog that was written by Helen and Ruth Erickson and designed by Connie Pirtle, was this one quote, which was, for me, so amazing, which was, enabling individuals to make choices, which is the heart of the democratic society. And that's teaching.
Yeah. Bill Flynn, you told me that Black Mountain is still teaching you. How so?
Oh, absolutely. Halfway through the show, I realized that I was looking at the museum school back in 1969. Bill Bagnell took over, got rid of grades, got rid of heads of departments, put in sound, video, and started a school that was happening with the students. The students voted on everything. I had to actually fight to keep drawing in the curriculum at one point. And I think he took it all from Black Mountain. I never realized how much influence that had. And I really wish now we could start some smaller Black Mountains all over the country.
We got to reinvent it before this hour
is done. Absolutely. Because
it
seems like this idea that you were just talking about, you know, they let things happen. And that is so important. Now everything is closing in. You know, everything is art schools cost too much money. They really do. It's a lot simpler. Go out in the woods and find stuff. Find an artist that you think is interesting and study with them.
It's almost comical to reflect on Lou Manin's line that this was art before money was invented, sort of, before came to mean everything. Just passionate ideas and ideals drove the whole thing. But take it to the next step. These collective clusters of imagination, almost nothing but imagination, and at moments when the species needed these bursts of humane thinking. You think Bloomsbury, Virginia Woolf, and Lloyd Keynes in London in the 30s. But I always think of the Concord Circle around Emerson, Hawthorne, Thoreau, Melville, Whitman. I think of the Harlem Renaissance. I think of the Duke Ellington Band as a collective in its own right of incredibly powerful individuals. Free thinkers at various times in Greenwich Village or North Beach, San Francisco. Luc Manin's own metaphysical club, Paris in the 20s. The common thread is artists to the rescue. We're in deep doo-doo here, and we need not economists, not engineers, not politicians, but imaginative spirits.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, I agree with you on what you're saying about all these wonderful sort of, you know, cauldrons of creativity and what they've had in common is something to talk about. This is the one side of Black Mountain, though, that I slightly worry about, this idea of artists to the rescue. you know, I think that, you know, it does provide a model of kinds. And you know, there are so many interesting metaphors to think about. When we think about, you know, Joseph Albers' understanding of the relativity of color, we might think of also relational aspects between humans in a democratic society. And I think, you know, Taylor touched on this a moment ago. But, you know, is it Is it realistic to think of Artists to the Rescue? Aren't we sort of giving a rose-tinted view of Black Mountain? I mean, it was pretty dysfunctional a lot of the time as well, absolutely riven by internal jealousies and politics and all that kind of stuff. So, and don't forget, they were this sort of isolated college far from everywhere else.
Which had to be a good thing. Conflict is something else, but that's sort of the price you pay. I wonder, what was the dog whistle signal that went out, sort of get thee to Asheville, to a very particular slice of spirits? Bill Flynn, I mean...
I remember reading that de Kooning and Elaine wanted to get out because it's going to be too hot in New York. And they wanted a place to paint, and it was just going to be a great spot. And I think the fact that he was there, and he and Albers butted heads constantly. And someone said to Albers, well, why did you have him here? Because he's the opposite of me. And I think that was a major concept for creating an artist of any sort. I mean, to have artists looking at a conflict between two powers, I think many times in review boards at the museum school or someplace, there's two faculty and they disagree. It's the best thing for the student to hear.
And isn't that such a great sort of compliment to Albers, you know, that he had the
Absolutely.
Courage to do that, to welcome people who would see things differently. And I think he's the crucial part of the whole story and
Absolutely.
And what makes Black Mountain sort of, you know, different to the sort of loosey-goosey, for want of a better word, sort of idealism that we often talk about when we talk about artistic communities. He gave it a kind of backbone, and it was something that was very large-spirited, very magnanimous. He would welcome opposite viewpoints, but he also encouraged a kind of discipline. That idea of him as the great disciplinarian, I mean, it was actually key to the whole place's success, even if it was something that generated creativity by a reaction against it. And
Absolutely.
That's an interesting point, I think, about
I agree.
Art schools.
He's the Emerson sort of at the center in the Concord scene. But there are other striking connections. Black Mountain College was surrounded by the war, or it surrounded the war.
Right.
The Germans are coming out of the burning Nazi moment, but they're all around World War II and then the start of the Cold War. Emerson Circle... sort of anticipating the Civil War, and they were abolitionists and visionaries about it. After the Civil War, they give way to the sort of the William James, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. search for a pragmatic way to avoid such a colossal and heedless, reckless mistake. And that's where American pragmatism comes from. In other words, I'm still looking for the connection with this moment. And the signal going out to that, you know, our politics, our military means are blowing up in our face. What do we do? And who will answer the call today? Taylor.
Wow, that's a question that's hard to answer. I guess my first response to that is much smaller groups of people will be trying to answer to that. In other words, there's, I feel like, a movement afoot, and it goes back to what you were saying, Bill, where a lot of the younger artists that I am working with are moving away from the larger cities, are wanting to work together in smaller communities. Hmm. And I don't think they're doing that in order to make a utopian community, because I actually think it's hard for people to believe in utopian communities anymore right now. But I feel like that they still believe in their right and ability to express their own humanness. And I guess if you were going to ask what could possibly, I don't know, save us, but maybe give us hope, is when we see art that makes us remember our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's really an answer, but that's the only thing that I can come up with. And that as an educator and as an artist, that we try to help our students see better, so they might see their own humanity.
But I think something that has to happen is art and technology have to get together in a way that's not that right now art is kind of in a separate situation. And I think when MIT's Media Lab and various other institutions start allowing the cross-fertilization, so to speak, to happen, the real art is going to start to happen. You know, the concept of a fine art, a painting now having the same power as it did years ago is gone. You know, there's too many things have to happen, and there's going to have to be a kind of a conundrum, a chaos. And out of the chaos, a certain kind of order will begin again. You know, Dick Lyons, who was a director at the aquarium, designer and all, we both said, you know, maybe all the art schools should close for a year or two. You know, let people find out whether they're going to do it or not, and how do you pull it together?
This sounds like a stray notion, but it came to me. We were starting up in Black Mountain 10 days ago when David Bowie died. And this huge audience around the world, including my kids, rose up to mourn him. And something clicked. Here's a singer, songwriter, performer, cross-dresser, also a painter, international, interdisciplinary creator who made the most of his sexual ambiguity and his all-round human mystery. And I thought, so many BMC impulses personified in one guy that people felt more strongly about than I knew. What does that tell you? Another leap. Sebastian.
Well, I mean, I agree. You know, and I think all of those impulses are there at Black Mountain. And I love what Taylor said about, you know, art making us see our own humanity. I think, you know, on the other hand, though, that art needs to be humble in its relationship to politics. I mean, we're talking about, you know, serious crises in the world. And I think that you solve crises, if you solve them at all, through politics, not through art necessarily. I think art does, however, have an absolutely crucial role to play just in that simple sense of making us see our own humanity. So, you know, that's the only sort of note of caution that I would insert into all the hagiography around Black Mountain. I just think it's an extraordinary phenomenon. It's so rich in complication, and so suggestive. And there are so many things to do with creativity and different ways of looking at creativity that people who went to Black Mountain and who taught there kind of burst open in the same way that Bowie burst open things that had been opened up by the Beatles and by the Stones and so on and brought that very 70s flavor and as you say, the cross-dressing and the openness to so many different strains, and all that's there in Black Mountain. And it's something that we love it for, we celebrate it for, both the minor artists and the major artists who came out of it. And I think it can teach us models about communities, because when we see our own humanity, we see that we aren't individuals. We are members of communities. And there, I think Black Mountain can teach us both positive things and negative things. I mean, there are a lot of things that went wrong there as much as went right. And that can teach us lessons as well.
I think that I'm just thinking about something that has to do with artists that I love, that we love. And one thing about them is that they, and this is going back to David Bowie, is just to think that you're watching somebody find something out. David Bowie was moving through these different times of his life, he was finding out. You know,
which
he was finding
so
out. He was exploring and inventing things, and he was in the present tense of that new experience. And that is so exciting to think about. And that's what we saw. That's what we see when we go to the show and we see this kind of exploration. It's discovery. It's as simple as discovery.
It is.
And it's really exciting as a viewer to feel that when you're looking at an artist's work.
Right.
Last word, Bill Flynn. Where are we going from here?
We got to dare it a lot. We have to push beyond the normal boundaries. I think the idea that to let things happen in a way that keeps your mind open.
Let's do it. Thank you, Bill Flynn and Taylor Davis and Sebastian Smee. Thanks also to Luke Menand, Ted Dreyer, Ruth Erickson, and to the helpful folks at the ICA, especially Colette Randall and Kate Shaman for many of the recordings you heard this hour. We're going out on music from another Black Mountain College affiliate, Roland Hayes. You can find terrific BMC photographs and all the artworks mentioned on our website, radioopensource.org, along with a conversation with the late great poet of the Ozarks, C.D. Wright. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Max Larkin, Zach Goldhammer, and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.